Well, hello. I'd like to thank you for letting me join you again on the Prison Pod. I want to remind you this show is for you. I want to hear from you, your questions and comments about the program. So I hope you have a piece of paper and a pen ready. If not, we always put the address in on the podcast link. But if you want to write us, it's the Prison Pod, Post Office Box 294, Orono, and that's ORONO, Maine, 04473. I'm so glad to have you join us again today. I have a great guest coming in. His name is Sean Wilson. His job is at dream.org, I believe, but he has so much more to talk about. And I'm going to bring him up right now. Hi,
Hello,
Sean. How are
Valerie.
you today?
I'm good. How are you, Valerie?
I'm doing great. You've been up to a lot of things recently. Do you want to start with that, or do you want to start a little bit about dream.org?
I can start a little bit about me. I can talk about, who I am. And then we can go ahead and segue into a little bit about the work that dream.org is doing.
Okay, great.
So my name is Sean Wilson. I'm a father. I'm a husband. I'm a son. I'm a brother. I'm a committed individual that seeks to bring about transformational change in all systems that has impact us that has impacted us as a society adversely. I am someone who works specifically in the area around criminal justice reform. And my commitment to work in this area stems from my direct experience within the criminal legal system, having served 17 years in Wisconsin's Department of Corrections, from juvenile to the age of 34. I've since been home coming up on 7 years, and I would say I hit the ground running. While I was in prison, I knew that I wanted to come home and share and also expose the Department of Corrections for not being true to its mission, so to speak. The Department of Corrections has a mission statement that is universal, I believe, that it is going to rehabilitate and reform the individuals that come into its custody. However, as someone who was in the custody of the Department of Corrections for 17 years, I confidently and I confidently say that that is not what they did for me. They did not rehabilitate, nor did they reform me. In fact, I took on that responsibility myself. The only thing that the Department of Corrections provided me was space and time. And so I took advantage of that space as well as that time to do internal work, in which I came home a more humane, healed, restored, passionate individual about working on the things that affect us all here in America as it pertains to criminal justice reform. And so that's just a little bit about myself and my genesis into the work around criminal justice reform.
Okay, could you bring up a little bit about child incarceration? Talk a little bit about that, because that's one thing we haven't discussed a lot on the program.
Absolutely. I think, we are a society that talks a lot about data. That, what does the data say? Data guides our next steps. And as it pertains to child incarceration, the data says that young people, brains aren't fully formed until they are well into their 20s. However, we as a society tend to hold young people within our criminal legal system to a higher standard, to an adult standard, when they give in to indiscretion and commit a crime. And so, what I mean by that is that I, as a 17-year-old kid, committed a crime. I was immediately or automatically waived into adult court, and I was charged and sentenced as an adult. However, I was a juvenile. I was not even old enough to purchase cigarettes, alcohol, or either even cast a ballot. However, the courts felt that I was of sound mind to be held to the same standards that we hold adults to within the criminal legal system. And so my story isn't unique, because this is happening to thousands of young people all across this country, where they are being sentenced as adults, although the brain science says that our brains aren't fully formed. And as a result of that, we should be held to the standards that are in place for juvenile delinquency. And so that is an area that needs to, like, really be reformed in a conversation around why we as a criminal legal system feel that it's okay to sentence a child the same way that we sentence an adult.
So let's talk a little bit about your actual work that you do at Dream.org. Are you involved with the justice.org piece of that?
Absolutely. So here at Dream.org, our mission is closing prison doors and opening doors of opportunity. I am the organizing director in our justice program. My role entails me building out nationwide capacity to pass transformational criminal justice reform legislation at the local, state, and federal level. And so basically what that looks like is me building nationwide capacity by cultivating relationships with directly impacted individuals, individuals who are formerly incarcerated and who have an interest in changing the laws in their states, who have an interest in doing direct service reentry work. My role is to build a relationship with these individuals and see what it is that they need as it pertains to training and resources. And we as an organization have a training program called the Dream Justice Cohort, where we train directly impacted leaders all across this country on how to organize, on how to build out a campaign, on how to lobby elected officials, on how to share their story succinctly but impactfully. I am also helping leaders at the local and state level access funding to scale their advocacy. If they run their own nonprofit, we're helping them secure funding dollars to do that. And so we're committed here at Dream.org to elevating and centering the voices of directly impacted individuals, because we believe that they are the closest to the problem, therefore closest to the solution. And so we're working intentionally on a daily with directly impacted men, women, and children all across this country to bring about legislation and policy that's going to reduce the footprint of mass incarceration. That is what we're doing at the local level. At the federal level, we're currently working to get a piece of legislation passed called the Equal Act. The Equal Act is it gets rid of the disparity between it gets rid of the disparity between crack and powder cocaine. Previously, it was 18-1. The Equal Act will make it 1-1. And so we're working with the U.S. Congress to ensure that this legislation makes it over the finish line. We're bringing leaders from all across this country who have been impacted by the Equal Act, whether they have been directly impacted by the Equal Act, or there are folks who have family members, loved ones, who are currently incarcerated under on a drug sentencing who may be impacted by this. So we're bringing those folks to D.C. to have conversations with elected officials, because, again, those who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution. And so we want these leaders to share with these elected officials why they should, one, support the Equal Act, and two, listen to the voices and experiences of those who are proximate to the very issues we're asking them to address.
Could you just touch a little bit on the racial part of that Equal Act?
Absolutely. Thank you. And thank you for mentioning that, because I think that is the most crucial piece of the Equal Act. And so although it will get rid of the disparity between crack and powder cocaine. The reason why we're working so urgently to get this legislation passed is because if you happen to be a white man or woman who get caught in possession of powder cocaine, and I, a black man, get caught in possession of crack cocaine, of the same amount. So you can get, you can be in possession of 5 grams of powder cocaine. I can be in possession of 5 grams of crack cocaine. You may get a 5-year sentence. I may receive a 50-year sentence. And so the disparity is very egregious in the sentencing of black people in comparison to white people. And so we're working urgently to get this legislation passed, because that disparity has disrupted so many families, so many communities, and has sent individuals to prison for decades, whereas their white counterparts have received a slap on the wrist or have served their sentence and have returned home to their families and their communities. And so we feel that there needs to be some form of equality in the sentencing around drug laws and drug sentencing, where black and black, brown and white people are concerned.
Thank you so much. You did a really wonderful job at explaining that. And a lot of people don't understand what that issue was. And it, you know, to me, it was very racially motivated. Absolutely. When it was written. So we've touched a little bit on the prison system, but I'd like to go a little more in depth than that. You said that you were responsible for your own healing. Can I assume that there was no programming for you while you were in?
Yes, because so here's the thing about what goes on in prison. So they have, of course, HSED programming, GED programming, and some vocational training. That is great. It is good that those trainings are available. But as you know, we've transitioned as a society into like a very technical world where technology is taking over everything. And so I think room for growth within the Department of Corrections will be pivoting towards programming that teaches the men and women within the confines of prison how to do coding and how to navigate the tech world, because these are the jobs of the future. When I was doing time, I was only given the opportunity to participate in vocational programming that I have not even used since I've been out. And that was bricklaying and masonry. Not saying that this isn't a valuable skill set to have. What I'm saying is that we need to, yes, keep those type of vocational trainings, but we need to also add vocational training that keeps up with the time in which we're living in, so that the men and women, the 95% who will return home to society, are able to come home and secure employment within these sectors. But more than anything, where the DOC is lacking is in trainings and programming around mental health, around substance abuse. Many individuals who come to prison are already dealing with all types of trauma. Childhood trauma in prison only exacerbates it. And the reason why it exacerbates it is because they have no programming that really addresses it. You can put me in an anger management program, allow me to see, let me watch a video and give me a packet or a worksheet to fill out and answer questions about how did this video make me feel, to determine if I'm able to navigate my feelings of anger in this moment. And I feel programming like that, those type of programming that offers that type of curriculum is inefficient, insufficient. It doesn't get to the root cause of the problem. And so I think we need more trainings in prison that addresses trauma. We need more trainings in prison that really get to the root cause of addiction, because many individuals who are in prison or why they were sent to prison stems from an addiction. And so those are programmings that are much needed in our prison system that consists of more than handing folks a packet and saying, complete this packet. And once you complete the packet, you turn it in and you get a certificate. So you will go through a 3-month training, and each class consists of you watching a video, having a conversation, and then you fill out a paper, you fill out a packet, and you're getting a certification, but you're not getting to the root cause of why individuals do the things that they do or have done the things that they've done. You're not really asking the questions of where did you begin to pivot and go in a direction of, you know, criminogenic behavior. None of that is teased out. None of that is extracted, nor are conversations that will extract that information is being had in a prison setting. Prisons are all about incapacitation. They're not about rehabilitation at all. And so you as an individual have to take it upon yourself to do that internal work. You as an individual have to take it upon yourself to bury yourself in those books, bury yourself in positive, constructive conversations that's going to contribute to you becoming a successful individual upon your release into society. But more than anything, that will contribute, you want it to contribute to your success as you navigate this thing called prison life, because prisons are very toxic, violent environments. And it's easy to, you know, become angry, to become resentful. It's easy to engage in fights and all types of things that keeps you distracted from what you need to be focused on, which is healing, which is betterment. It's easy to fall prey to the noise that is happening around you. But if you want to come home and be successful, you have to shut off the noise and really begin to do that internal work, because doing that internal work now, where you have nothing but time, allows you to transition back into society successfully. A lot of folks look at me and they wonder, how is it that you've been able to succeed in the way that you have succeeded? And I tell folks that I got out of prison before I got out of prison. I got out mentally before I got out physically. What did that look like? It looked like me doing that internal work. It looked like me studying. It looked like me having conversations with individuals who really was unsatisfied with their current plight. It was having conversations with staff members who were receptive and understood that we all make mistakes. We all make mistakes. And here we are taking accountability and responsibility for these mistakes. So how do we move forward? How do we move forward where we're having a positive impact on our family, on our community, on our children? Like, these are the type of relationships and conversations that need to be cultivated more in prison. We really have to start turning these prisons into think tanks, because once you begin to think and analyze and put forth viable solutions to address the root causes of these problems, then they're going to kick you out. Prisons aren't a place for, prison isn't a place for thinkers. And Frederick Douglass has this quote where he said that it's impossible to make a slave out of a thinking man, out of a thinking person. It's impossible, because you're constantly analyzing and questioning the oppression that is being bestowed upon you. And not only are you questioning and analyzing the oppression that is being bestowed upon you, you're also resisting it. You're resisting it. And 365, 7 days a week, 365 days in a year, oppression is being perpetrated and perpetuated on individuals in a carceral setting all across this country.
That's a very valid point, too. There are some states that are a little more progressive than others, but it needs to be looked at across the country. And that's the other thing, is it should be being done across the country. It should not be a handful of states. You know, and another thing is, I'm going to step back a bit, but you had mentioned about the trauma and addiction, and it seems like those things aren't addressed until the last 6 months before someone's released. So if you've got a long bid, you have all that time that you're still fighting with all the things that brought you into prison, years and years and years of stuff piling up in trauma, in levels of trauma. And then they say, oh, in the last 6 months, we're just going to take care of everything, you know, absolutely. And it's just setting people up for failure.
It is. You're absolutely right. And that's how most programming in prisons operate. If you have, for example, say you have 10 years in prison and you've done 7-8 years of that sentence, you only become eligible for this programming 2 years prior to you get out. And I'm not saying that you can't get what you need in that 2 years, but what I'm saying is that you need to start from day one. Like, programming needs to start from day one of your entrance into prison so that you can really begin to build the mindset that is needed to take advantage of the programming, and not only take advantage of the programming, but also begin to implement and build out the life that you want after prison. Like, I live my life every day as if I was already out in the free world, yet I still put on the green uniform. I still put on green state boots. I still walk the rec yard, and I still saw everyone around me who were my fellow captives experiencing a variety of trauma responses, and they weren't getting the support that they needed. And they've only probably been in prison 3, 6, 9, or 12 months. And those are the most critical months that an individual is experiencing so many emotions, so many traumas individuals are experiencing within that first, 3 to 6 months. And that is the most opportune time, in my opinion, to ensure that they get the programming and the treatment that they are in most need of, because they've been triggered, because that now they're in a foreign environment. When your body is exposed to a foreign disease or anything that it's not used to, it's going to react a certain way. And it's the same with individuals coming in from society into a confined space that is sensory depriving, that is violent, where you're always having to look over your shoulder to ensure that no one causes harm to you. There's a trigger. There's a trauma response that takes place. And I think the prison system need to ensure that they're getting individuals immediate support upon entrance, not 2 years prior to their release or 6 months prior to their release, immediately. Because if you don't and you wait until 2 years or 6 months, you're only going to send folks out unprepared.
I think this is intensified even more the younger that you go in. So you figure if somebody goes in, you know, like a lot of the guys that I worked with went in before they were 18 and they had 20 or 30 years to do. And with that amount of time, from 16 to 25, you still have so much of your brain development happening, and they're not treated any different than anybody else that's in there. So they're not saying, oh, well, wait a minute, these are youth and we need to, maybe handle them with kid gloves a little bit. Oh no, they're just like everybody else. And they're thrown into gen pop with everybody else and have to fight for themselves. And so that's really one thing that does bother me with the youth. Something else you have mentioned about getting into books, I always like to ask people who read, was there any one book that really influenced you at the beginning of your soul searching?
Or author? Yes, there's this book by what's the name of the book? there's this book called the broader file. The broader file, 22 essays. 22 essays on the African American experience, written by Anthony Browder. That is a book that a good friend of mine gave me to read. The first time that he was a tutor. So let me set the scene. So I was in school in prison. And a group of us, myself and several other guys, were, you know, joking around in class, shooting the dozens. And the teacher said to us a couple of times, "Hey, can you guys keep it down and do your work?" And so, you know, we ignored her, of course, and continued to do what we were doing. But I felt a pat on my shoulder, and I turned around, very quickly, and it was the tutor. And the tutor whispered to me and said, "Hey, man, could you tell them to, you know, keep the noise down and to focus on their work? Otherwise, they're going to get a conduct report, because, you know, this is the second time that the teacher asked us to keep it down." And so he was doing us a favor by saying, "Hey, you know, you guys should take what she's saying to heart." And so I told the guys, like, "Hey, let's keep it down." And we proceeded to finish our work, and then class let out. So once class let out, I'm walking with this guy who is the tutor. We spark up a conversation about, you know, why I was there and, you know, what did I hope to get out of, you know, attending school, all of these things. Just, you know, a back and forth of trying to get to know me and I'm trying to get to know him. Long story short, he handed me a book and he was like, "Hey, man, you seem like, you know, you're a person that reads a lot. You're interested in books. I think you should check this book out." And at the time, you know, I'd probably been in prison probably a little bit under a year, probably 9 months at the time. And I hadn't developed a routine or a regimen of reading and studying. I haven't done that yet. And so I took the book from the guy and I went back to my cell, set the book down. Later that evening, I opened the book and I read the introduction and I read the conclusion. I took the book back to the tutor and I was like, "Hey, man, this was a great book." And so he began to, you know, question me about the book. And so I started mixing the intro and the ending together. I started mixing them together. And so he started to ask me about the meat of the book. And I didn't have a clue about the meat, the inside of the book. I just knew the intro and the conclusion. That's it. So once he realized that I hadn't read the book, he said, "Hey, man, I really think you would like this book. Check it out. And let's have a conversation about it." I went back, Valerie, and I read this book from cover to cover in one sitting. And then I proceeded to handwrite freehand and copy the entire book. So the book probably is about 90 pages, I believe. I freehand the entire book. And I still actually have the book in some boxes somewhere around here. But that book had the most impact on my life, and set me on a journey of, you know, self-awakening, a journey of understanding historical context and the plight of African Americans here in the United States of America. And from there, I began to read other books that he wrote. I read, you know, Now Valley Civilization or Now Valley Contributions to Civilization. I also read the part two and the part three of his book. That was the book that was the catalyst for me.
I always love hearing stories about reading, because one of the first things that we did when we started going into the prison was to encourage reading. And we heard a lot of times, "Oh, they got lousy books in here and there's nothing I want to read." So we said, "Well, keep a book list of what you want and we'll start buying the books." Yeah. You're like, "What?" But that's, you know, and we were very fortunate because we got a $2,000 grant from the Tides Foundation, and we were able to spend it all on books, or 90% of it on books. And it was great because they were the guy's own books. They weren't a library book. So if it was like, you know, Black's Book of Law, it's something that they could continue to use, you know. So I love it when I hear that it starts out with reading, because first of all, knowledge can't be taken away from you. Mm-hmm. And to me, reading is a great form of freedom. You, even if it's a comic book or a fantasy book, it takes you away from where you are. And you're constantly learning when you read. It increases your vocabulary. If you're smart, you keep a dictionary with you, which I did through all of school because I didn't understand half of it. Yeah. Constantly was looking. But, you know, that's what I tell the guys, you know, get a dictionary, little pocket dictionary, and if there's a word in there you don't know, mark it. Start using it. Use it in your language, you know. So this reading is such an opportunity for people, and in such a life-changing opportunity, because there's so much you can learn from reading. Yeah. And now with the tablets and many of the facilities too, there's even more available for them.
Absolutely. I think, I often say in, you know, interviews that I do, that I've traveled all across the world, and a lot of podcast hosts, they'll look at me and they're, you know, or interviewers, they'll look at me and be like, you traveled all across the world? And then it'll hit them like, oh, okay, you've traveled all across the world in your readings. And that's, and to your point, that's exactly what reading does. It is probably the best form of self-care. It is probably one of the best programs that prison can invest in. And when I say invest in, I mean they can ensure that there are libraries that has quality books in it, where, you know, you don't get five chapters into a book and then two chapters are missing. So you don't know what happened in those two chapters. And so you don't finish reading the book. And so I think prisons can definitely invest in libraries that have everything that a person can possibly need to become better human beings. And that right there can do miracles if they were to invest in libraries.
Another thing that I recently have really been looking into is virtual reality. I don't know if you know much about it, but I think it would be a remarkable thing to bring into the prisons, just to start out with meditation, relaxation, and mindfulness experiences. And then the actual being able to go to a grocery store or to the DMV to have that experience, especially for guys that have been in for a really long time, that technology has just come leaps and bounds. A lot of guys went in, there wasn't a cell phone, you know, and now we have cell phones out of computers. Yep. So there's, you know, so I think there's a lot that can be expanded on with virtual reality too, and not a huge cost to the facilities.
Yep. And there's a lot of organizations and nonprofits and, you know, employers who would love to go into many of these facilities and facilitate, you know, workshops and trainings. I just think that there needs to be a mind shift, because the perception that administrators of the Department of Corrections, the perception that they have is that they're there to punish us, that they're there to ensure that our lives is miserable. And you have guards and administrators who are great at reminding folks of that. However, that is a disservice. You know, you're doing a disservice to society, and more so you're doing a disservice to that person. And if you're a correctional officer, that implies that you are someone dispensing corrective measures to behavior that is not right. And so there should be some type of social work component when guards and prison administrators interact with the quote unquote inmate population, or the in Wisconsin, we call individuals in prison people within our care, or persons in our care. Like, we got to really begin to change the narrative around how we talk about the people who are giving in to indiscretion that ends in a prison sentence. Like, you're calling folks inmate, convict. These are all pejorative terms. You have many prisons and many secretaries of Department of Corrections all across this country who are saying, you know what? We're not going to call them inmate. We're not going to call them offender. We're not going to call them convict, because these are very negative, dehumanizing terms. We're going to call them language. We're going to refer to them with language that is healing, with language that reminds them on a daily basis that they are human, that they made a mistake. And it is important that they acknowledge, take responsibility and accountability for that mistake, and begin to build out a plan of how they will return to society and contribute successfully to the forward progress of not only themselves, but their families, their community, and the world at large. Those are the type of narratives that needs to be prevalent within our carceral setting.
All excellent points. I have one more thing I want to ask you before I forget it. You had something that made me do some thinking, and that was you had a comment on being viewed as a liability when you come home. And that is something I think that affects so many. Could you address that a little?
Yeah, I think what a lot of what society at large don't realize or understand, and we're working daily to help them understand that, is that when you are removed from society for a period of time and you ultimately return to that society, there are so many needs that that must be met in order for you to successfully navigate the reentry process. Three of those immediate needs are employment, housing, and transportation. Landlords aren't inclined to rent to you if you have a felony on your record, or if you have a criminal history. They're not inclined to rent to you because they are perceiving you as a liability. They're perceiving you as someone who may run off and not pay rent. They're perceiving you as someone who may destroy their property. Same with employers. Employers are perceiving individuals with a criminal conviction in probably the most negative light, that we don't want this person working for our company, because what if they decide to revert back to this behavior, causing harm to our employees and in turn causing harm to us as a company, with liability lawsuits being filed because we hired someone with a criminal conviction and we put our staff at risk. And so that is the immediate, like, that is the context that I will use to explain why I say, you know, we who have served a period of time in prison are perceived as a liability for those two reasons in particular. But as we navigate the world, there's thousands of collateral consequences that is heaped upon us upon reentering society. And with those collateral consequences, we're liable. We're liable for things that we could not even imagine. We can be in the wrong. We can be walking through an area where crime has just been committed, and we can be pulled to the side for questioning. And because of our criminal history or our previous stay in a carceral setting, because of that, we can be accused of being the perpetrator of that crime. without any outcry or outrage from society or the folks that are present and are being questioned as well. Because more than anything, they want the cops to know that they didn't have anything to do with it. But lo and behold, you tell them that this guy, you know, is a previously incarcerated and that they just came home from prison and they have a rap sheet as long as the Nile River. Then those folks who are being questioned ends up turning on you and say, yes, I think I might have saw them around the time that this crime took place, making you a liability.
It brought me to the thought of being tried by society before you ever land in court through newspapers. Somebody has a new offense. It could be something that they're not even guilty of, and the newspapers go crazy and say, yep. Oh, well, they were convicted 25 years ago of this, and they had a juvenile record. They say nothing about the 25 years in between of what that person might have been or what their accomplishments were. They're only looked at for the original crime, and we have to stop doing that. That stigma has to be reduced somehow. Absolutely. Because there's a, you know, once people get inside of a prison, if they go in there to work or are volunteers, the first thing you realize is there are people in there that could be your dad, your brother, your mom, your sister, your son, your daughter. And that's how it is. People in there have families like everybody else. And some of us have opportunities others do not have. And there's things that happen in life that sometimes are not the way we would have chosen to have gone. But yep. We should not have to be punished the rest of our lives for it. And there should be a chance for personal redemption, let alone anything to do with society. People should be able to come home feeling as a whole person again, not yep. come home feeling like, excuse me, a piece of crap. And, you know, everybody hates me because of my past. You know, we need to start opening our arms and welcoming people home and giving them that hope and opportunity to survive again and to become part of the world and not always be stuck to the side and looked at as other than.
Yeah, as a society, I think we have that bad. We have it bad at othering people, no matter, you know, what situation a person has come out of or what experience a person may have. That's something that is very prevalent in this country and throughout the world. It's othering. It's easy to other people. And we don't realize how detrimental that is to that person's psyche. And we don't realize how detrimental that is to ourselves when we perpetuate that type of narrative about someone that we don't know anything about. And that's why those of us who are previously and formerly incarcerated are committed to educating society by not one leading with our story. In a lot of cases, we don't lead with our story that, hey, I've served X amount of time in prison. We only use our story when it's applicable to the conversation that is being had. And when you inject your story into the conversation, folks are in awe. Folks are shocked. They're in disbelief that they're having a conversation with someone who just spent a decade or more in prison. And the conversation was the most intellectual conversation. It was a conversation that provided inspiration. It is a conversation that provoked thought, etc. But as soon as you inject, and by the way, I'm formerly incarcerated, that can change the perception that that person have of you because you shared with them that you are formerly incarcerated. In some cases, it holds a great deal of weight, especially if you're talking about something proximate to the criminal legal system. They can potentially walk away saying that you have provided them with a lens that they may have never been provided with had they not had a conversation with you, someone who has experienced serving time in prison.
That's why I love having these conversations. You know, we learn from each other.
Yep.
And who better to learn from than people with a direct experience? I think that more people that have dealt with incarceration need to have a place at the table when it's being discussed. Who better to come up with thoughts and ideas of how to change things than those who are directly impacted from it?
Yep, absolutely. I think everything that we do in this world, everything that we embark on, every journey that we embark on, you know, professionally within various fields, within various professions, we always lean on our predecessors. What is the precedent? You know, what came before this? And we build off of that. And I think what is happening in this country right now is that formerly incarcerated individuals who have developed analysis about all of the problems that exist within the criminal legal system, as well as all of the problems that exist within correctional settings. We've identified what the problems are, but more than anything, we've identified what are the solutions, what is out there to begin to curb the harm that this system is having on Black and brown people and white people as well, all across this country. What are some best practices we can employ? And we're hungry for that. We're hungry for that. And when I say we're hungry for that, I'm saying those who are on both sides of the fence, those who are impacted and those who are running the systems in which impacted individuals are sentenced into. If we weren't hungry for it, then we wouldn't be taking tours over to Europe and Norway to see how they do corrections. And when we go and do these tours of other countries in the free world, we come back, you know, with the realization that we've been doing things wrong for so long, and we have to begin to change the way that we do things, because 95% of these individuals who are currently incarcerated are going to return home to our communities. How do we want them to return? Do we want them to return bitter? Do we want them to return angry, resentful? Do we want them to return looking to settle the score? Like, how do we want people to return to society? Is the big question that we must answer. And if we don't want them to return to society feeling those feelings that are adverse to all of us as a society, then we need to do everything in our power to improve the living conditions within the correctional setting. We need to improve the programming within the correctional setting. We need to invest in literature, in facilitation, in workshops that's really going to begin to help these individuals do that internal work and heal from that childhood trauma that has led them to prison in the first place. We really got to put an emphasis on healing, because hurt people hurt people. And if we're not healing people so that people can continue to be healed, then we will continue to build prisons, and we will continue to build on this plantation called the Department of Corrections.
I think that's a pretty good place to start wrapping it up. That was, you really touched on some wonderful points today, and I'm so glad that we've had a chance to talk. Is there anything else that you might want to add that maybe we forgot to go with? Or
it's not anything that I like to add per se. Or there's not anything that I don't think I said. I think you did a great job in that, asking me those questions. I really appreciate the questions that you asked. I would like to say to your audience, those who are currently incarcerated and the family members who are in support of them on the outside or the free world, utilize this time to really go deep within yourself and understand what your purpose is and begin to take the steps that prepares you for your release. Understand what your responsibility is first and foremost to yourself. And once you come into that understanding, you will know what your responsibility is to your family, your community, and the world at large. And once you have that understanding, the world is going to open up for you so that you can achieve all of those things that you set out to achieve in the confines of a prison cell right now. For the family members and the friends who are supporting or struggling to support your loved one who's currently incarcerated, continue to support them. Continue to let your presence be felt, whether that is on a visit, whether that is on a phone call, whether that is on a letter that is coming in. Continue to allow your presence to be felt. And also, if you're able to send material and books to your loved ones, be sure to send them those things that's going to help them successfully navigate the reentry process upon their release from prison. As I said at the top of the show, 95% of individuals currently incarcerated will return home to society. And so let's make sure that we as family members and friends are contributing to them returning whole.
Okay, I want to remind our listeners, we've been talking with Sean Wilson. And if you want to find out more about the work he's been doing, you can go to the website dream.org. And I will also add links on the site when this goes up. Sean, I would like to thank you so much for coming in and joining us today on the Prison Pod.
Thank you, Valerie, for having me.
All right, so we're going to wrap things up. This is Valerie Cartonio with the Prison Pod. We've had Sean Wilson here today as our guest. I'll be back in a few weeks with another piece. And again, don't forget to write the Prison Pod, Post Office Box 294, Orono, Maine, 04473. And don't forget, pick up a book.